Okay, we could do three off bounds. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay. Today is June 19th, 2010. Okay, we begin with salutation to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good morning, everybody. So today we will be taking sutta number 28 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Mahapatipadopama Sutta, or in English it's the Greater Discourse on the Simile of the Elephant's Footprint. Okay, and this sutta is spoken not by the Buddha himself, but by the Buddha's chief disciple. Venerable Sariputta. Okay, it's page 278. Okay, so the sutta begins when Venerable Sariputta calls the attention of the monks. And then he says to them, just as the footprint of any living being, of any living being that walks, can be placed within an elephant's footprint, and so the elephant's footprint is declared the chief among them because of its great size, so all wholesome states can be included in the Four Noble Truths. Actually, the Pali text that uses the expression here, kusala dhamma. which it's often used to mean good qualities, wholesome qualities, the good mental, personal qualities. But I'm not really sure that that quite fits the context so well. And it might be that the real sense is good teachings. Because the Four Noble Truths include not only good qualities, but also there are bad qualities in the Four Noble Truths. The Second Noble Truth is the origin of suffering, so that is mainly craving. Well, you could say greed, hatred, and delusion. But if we take it in the sense of all good teachings, then we could say that all of the good teachings of the Buddha are in some way unfolded out of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so now what Venerable Sariputta is going to do here, it's a feature quite distinctive of his way of treating topics in the Dhamma. And this is using a very, very close or precise and detailed analytical method. He's going to take the Four Noble Truths, and out of the Four Noble Truths take one truth, the truth of suffering, then break suffering into its constituents, and then take these one by one. Okay, so he begins by enumerating what are the Four Noble Truths. There's the Noble Truth of dukkha or suffering, the Noble Truth of the origin of suffering, the Noble Truth of the cessation of suffering, and the Noble Truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Okay, so now we have the Four Truths. Now, out of the Four Noble Truths, Sariputta takes the Noble Truth of suffering first. So he says, what is the Noble Truth of suffering? Then he takes the standard definition, birth is suffering, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, not to obtain what one wants is suffering. In short, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. Okay, so now he's taken out of the, he's defined the fourth, the first noble truth, and he ends with the five aggregates which summarize the whole truth of dukkha, of suffering. So actually all forms of suffering are contained within the five aggregates. Okay, so what are these five aggregates subject to clinging? Okay, they are the material form aggregate subject to clinging, the feeling aggregate subject to clinging, the perception aggregate subject to clinging, the mental formations are volitional activities, karmic activities. Okay, the volitional activities affected by clinging, and the consciousness aggregate affected by clinging. Okay, so here we have a pattern starting to emerge. Oh, I'm getting the signal that the battery is low. Okay, so out of the first noble truth, the different aspects of dukkha or suffering, Sariputta chooses the last one, the five aggregates, which really comprehend all the different forms of suffering. Since what is birth, but birth is the coming into being of the five aggregates. Aging is the aging, deterioration, decay of the five aggregates. Death is the breaking up or dissolution of the five aggregates. Then all of the other experiences of suffering in life all depend on this combination of the five aggregates. Okay, so then Sariputta raises the question, what are the five aggregates affected by clinging? Then he enumerates the five aggregates individually. And now, out of the five aggregates, he's going to choose the aggregate of material form. So he raises the question, what is the aggregate of material form affected by clinging? And then he says, it's the four great elements, four primary elements, and the material form derived from the four great elements. So we have two aspects to the aggregate of material form. On the one hand, primary matter, which is the four great elements, and then secondary matter, or derived matter, which is not really explained as such in the suttas, but probably derived matter would include the form, material form of the sense faculties, the material form of the sense objects, and then the space element is included in derived material form. Okay, but now out of these two aspects of material form, Sariputta chooses the four great elements. And then he raises the question, what are the four great elements? Okay, they are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So these are, we call them elements or dhatu. Pali word is dhatu. But they're, maybe we can call them four behavioral, four properties of matter, or four modes of the appearance of matter. So when matter is solid or substantial, then it's the earth element. When the matter becomes liquid, it's the water element. When the matter is vaporized, becomes gaseous, it's the air element or wind element. And then the heat, which is present in all forms of matter, is the fire element. Okay, so now Sariputta is going to raise the question. He's going to take each element in turn and then use it as a basis for an exposition of the whole teaching, almost the whole teaching. So you can see many different aspects of the teaching based on each of the four elements individually. So he raises the question, what, friends, is the earth element? Then he says the earth element may be either internal or external. Okay, what is the internal earth element? Then he gives the answer, whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified. Then it uses a technical term, it's translated here, clung to. But I think what's it being indicated by this term is organic, what we would call organic matter. That which is an integral part of the organic body. And now there's two ways to understand the four elements. And these two ways are used as the basis for the meditation on the elements. One way is in terms of the specific property that the element represents. And so in this case, we have the four elements represented by the properties: the earth element. Does everybody have this? So I'll take this now. Okay, so when we take the abstract properties, we say that each of the elements represents it's a kind of concrete symbol for a particular abstract physical property. And so what we call the earth element, it's not the ground or the soil, but it's the property of solidity. That property by virtue of which matter occupies space and provides resistance to compression. And so this property of the earth element can be experienced along a continuum, moving from hardness to softness. So when the earth element is more prominent, something is experienced as hard. As the earth element becomes, as the proportion of the earth element decreases, the object is experienced as soft. Okay, the water element is the property of liquidity. It means being a liquid. And it has the, one of the characteristics is flowing. So when things flow, they have this flowing property. That's the manifestation of the water element. But it's said that the water element also has the property of cohesion. That means it's the property because of which the particles of matter stick together and don't simply scatter. My supposition is that, you know, the formulators of this sort of theory of matter observed that when people were making, you know, the kind of Indian bread they call a chapati, it's like pancakes. So you put some flour out on a board, and then to get the flour to adhere, you have to sprinkle water into it, and then you mold it, and then it forms a lump of dough, and then one rolls the dough to make a flat cake and then puts it on the fire, and that becomes a chapati. Okay, so what makes the particles of dough stick together is the addition of the water. And so on the basis of this, the formulators of this view of matter assume that the liquid element or water has the property of making things stick together, the property of cohesion. Okay, then the third element is the fire element. And this is the symbolic representation. Fire is the symbolic representation of heat. So we know that all matter above absolute zero has some degree of heat, and that heat is the presence of the fire element. But in our actual concrete experience, the way we experience the fire element is relative to the heat of our own body. So if something has less heat than our own body, then we experience it as cool or cold. If something has more heat than our own body, then we experience it as hot. Actually, that's not quite true, because if it's 92 degrees outside, there's less heat than our own body, which has usually around 98.6 degrees, but we still experience 92 degrees as hot. Except those who come from Taiwan, if you think it's comfortable or normal. Anybody from Alaska here or Northern Canada? You're from Northern Canada. So when you're here in the winter, even if it's 20 degrees, then you experience it as warm, right? Okay, so anyway, the way we experience the presence of the heat element is along a continuum going from hot to cold. And then what is called the air element represents the property of movement or motion, or sometimes it's called distension. Distension is the property that makes things stiff and hard. Because probably they observed that if you take something like a balloon and then you blow into it and fill it with air, it expands and then it becomes stiff and hard. They would have noticed this with the bellows that they use for fanning a fire. When it fills with air, it becomes hard and stiff. And so they came to define the air element as either motion or distension. And then we experience the air element most concretely in expansion and contraction. For example, when we're breathing in, the lungs expand. When we breathe out, the lungs contract. And if one pays very careful attention to the body, as one breathes in, one could feel the expansion spreading through the whole body. When one breathes out, one could feel the contraction throughout the whole body. Okay, so according to the Buddha's teachings, all four elements are actually always present together. They're mutual conditions for one another. So whenever we have any kind of matter, all four elements are present. If I have something which is hard or solid, like this cover of the cup, okay, here, what is the prominent element? The earth element is prominent because it's hard and solid. But what enables the particles to stick together? It's the water element. And to my touch, it's a bit cool. So there's that's the heat element, but the heat element, it's relatively low, the presence of the heat element. And then even though we can't see it with our eyes, but there's constant motion taking place within the particles of this cap, that would be the air or wind element. Okay, so this is one way to understand the elements. And so when a meditator is practicing the meditation on the elements, normally they would begin by finding some part of the body which is hard and solid. For example, they usually recommend the teeth. One tries to get the sensation of hardness in the teeth. It could be the fingernail. It could be something like the elbows, where one could feel the bone, hardness of the bone. And in this way, one gets a sense of the hardness and solidity of the body. Then one has to refine the attention till one could flow or move the mind through the whole body and experience that hardness, solidity throughout the whole body. And wherever one notices softness, one also understands that is the earth element too. Okay, then to meditate on the water element, or to define the water element, one takes some bodily experience of liquidity within the body. Usually one will be instructed to get a sense of the saliva in the mouth. And then one focuses on the saliva until one gets a sense of the concrete experience of what it means to be liquid or fluid. And then one will go through the body trying to feel, to experience all of the flowing sensations in the body, the sensation of flowing of liquid material taking place. And also trying to get an experience of the cohesion or sticking together of the particles of matter within the body. Okay, then to get the experience of the heat element, one chooses some sensation of bodily heat. One could just choose any part of the body and focus on it until one can experience it as warm. If it's a cold day, then the meditation teacher might advise you to go next to a radiator or heater in order to feel the heat. And then one goes scanning the body to experience at very subtle levels the heat throughout the body. And then to get this in the experience of the air element, one will focus on the expansion and contraction, could be of the lungs or the abdomen as one breathes in and out. And then when one gets the experience of the gross experience of expansion and contraction, then one will go through the whole body scanning the whole body in order to pick up the subtle experiences of expansion and contraction taking place throughout the whole body. And so in this way one gets the experience of the four elements in terms of their abstract property, but one could actually experience it one can experience them concretely throughout the whole body. Okay, so that is a kind of subtle approach to understanding the four elements. But a more elaborate approach is to choose those particular organs or tissues of the body which manifest or display one or another of the elements more prominently. And this is the approach that Sariputta will take here. So first he defines or states the abstract property of the earth element. Whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and organic. Then he takes parts of the body which display the earth element more prominently, more distinctively. I think there are 20 parts he mentions. Head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, the diaphragm, the spleen, the lungs, intestines, mesentery, the stomach with its contents, the feces, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. This is called the internal earth element. Okay, so when it says whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid and solidified, this can include the earth element that's included throughout the whole body, even in those parts of the body taken to be to represent the water element. Okay, so now one focuses upon the earth element in the body, going first through these 20 parts of the body to get a sense of that hardness or solidity. And then when one is able to pick up the hardness or solidity, one can just focus on the presence of the earth element throughout the whole body. And so now one is separating the body from the environment and focusing upon the internal or bodily earth element. But now with the next sentence, Sariputta is going to, in a sense, depersonalize the body for break down the mental barrier, the mental boundary between the earth element of our own body and the environmental or external earth element. So he says, now both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. That is, between the earth element that I identify as being my body and the earth element that I identify as being external, there is a common characteristic, a shared characteristic, which is that property of hardness or solidity. So when I focus on how both the earth element of my body and the external earth element of soil, wood, metal, is just simply that property of solidity, of hardness, then I start to lose this distinct identification with the substance of the body. In fact, if we reflect, we could see that there's a constant exchange going on between our body and the environment. And so now I think this body is mine, and somebody puts a plate of food in front of me, and I think the food is outside of me, right? So if it's solid food, rice and so on, then I think external, if I'm reflective, I think external earth element. But I eat the food, it comes into the stomach, it gets digested, metabolized, the nutrients of the plate of food get taken out from the mass of food and become assimilated to my own body and used to construct new cells in my body. And so the solid earth element of the food becomes me. So next time somebody puts a plate of food in front of me, you can go up to the food and say, "Bhante, would you like some water with your human being?" Okay, then the food gets digested, but not all of it gets digested. Some of it goes into the large intestine in the form of feces. And as long as it's in the body, well, maybe we don't usually think this way, but we would be inclined to think that's still part of me. It's my body. But then we go to the toilet and it comes out and gets flushed away, and then it goes out and it becomes part of the external world. And then maybe, well, ideally it should be brought to a field where it can be fertilized, the field. And then it will become part of the external earth element. It disintegrates into the earth and becomes the earth element. Okay, so in this way we can see a continuous exchange of the earth element between the outer world and this inner organ, this organism that I call my body. And so what we do is to dissolve the distinction between them and see that they're just the earth element. And when we see that they're just the earth element, then we lose the sense of clinging or grasping to the body as being I or mine. And so Sariputta speaks about the earth element. He says, that should be seen as it actually is, with proper wisdom, thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And so one sees how the earth element of the body, that which I identify as being mine, is continuous with the earth element of the outer world, has the same property as that external earth element. Then we can contemplate this body in terms of the earth element as being not mine, not I, not myself. And then Sariputta says, when one sees it in this way as it actually is, with samapanyaya, with correct wisdom, with proper wisdom, with accurate wisdom, then one becomes disenchanted with the earth element. One loses the kind of enchantment or fascination with the earth element of one's own body, or with one's own body. And one makes the mind dispassionate towards the earth element. So one loses that passionate attachment towards the earth element of one's own body. So this is very useful instruction, because the body, normally it's a basis for certain very powerful kilesas or mental defilements. Fun now. So they tend to gather around the body. What are some of these mental afflictions that gather around the body, based on the body?
Hypochondria.
Yeah, but some, I mean, that's exceptional, but.
Lust?
Yeah, especially sexual desire focuses on the body.
Vanity,
that's a very important one. Some people who have, maybe their features are sort of naturally beautiful and attractive, and they become proud of the body. And then what happens when aging sets in? Excuse me?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
You have an experience.
Oh, she said something funny, I think you should share.
Oh, I said plastic surgery.
So what happens when aging sets in? Yeah. She said plastic surgery.
Well, in a way, the plastic surgery is rooted in the vanity.
Yeah.
Or something else besides vanity. What else?
Longing for life.
Rage and delusion.
It could be, but I'm thinking of something a little more specific.
Narcissism?
Yeah, well, narcissism is, maybe it's almost synonymous with vanity, but something else that goes along with it.
You mean like a tanha, a craving, trying to hold on to?
The tanha is there, yeah, but there's another. Tanha is probably there all the time, but what is it that makes the person want to undergo plastic surgery?
Oh, to maintain the image of self.
Maintaining the image of oneself, but there's this one specific word that I'm looking for.
Anxiety?
Yeah, that's actually, I had a different word in mind.
What?
But anxiety.
Anxiety, fear.
Yeah. Fear, that was the word that I had in mind. Since as the body starts to age, then one becomes anxious or afraid. Oh, I'm losing my beauty. I'm getting closer to to being an old, decrepit man or woman. I'll no longer be thought of as attractive by others. I'll lose my popularity. So I have to preserve this image of myself. So in order to dispel that or keep that fear at a distance, one has to go through the plastic surgery. Okay, so some of the things that focus on the body, the center around the body. We have lust, then there's tanha, which is the attachment to the body itself, vanity or pride. And maybe if somebody doesn't have such beautiful features, if they're very plain, or people think about them as homely or ugly, then what kind of feelings do they undergo? Shame or
inadequacy.
A sense of inadequacy, sometimes maybe dejection, despondency.
Or even anger.
Anger, yeah. And then there's fear or anxiety. Okay, but when one is able just to focus on this body, taking it in terms of the four elements, starting with the earth element, and see how this body is continuous, the elements of the body continuous with the external element, just transformations of the earth element, of the external elements, then one breaks that identification, thinking, this is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. Even if one practices this reflection a little bit on each day, you don't have to go through all of the elements, but just reflect on the body. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. It's like lifts a tremendous weight off one's shoulders. And one feels very much, and one comes to feel very much at ease with oneself. Because the body, for so many people, especially in modern America, where we have the idealized image of the perfect man, who's, you know, muscle-bound, youthful, the rib muscles showing, strong legs, handsome like a movie star, and then the woman has to be, they call it the hourglass figure, and beautiful flowing hair, and lovely facial features, looking like a supermodel or a movie star. And then if the girls, especially maybe like high school girls, college girls, if they don't measure up to that image, then they feel so miserable about themselves that they get into states of sometimes depression. What are the kinds of states they go into? What?
She said anorexia, like self-mortification.
Yeah. So that they don't want to eat in order to make themselves get very thin.
Yeah.
And bulimia, is that what
bulimia.
It is?
Bulimia.
Forcing oneself to throw up so that one will get thinner, is that?
Yes.
So you could splurge on Big Macs. What are some other things that the girls feel?
Well, there's drug and alcohol abuse.
Yeah, that's probably, this becomes a way to escape from those feelings of misery and a feeling of loss of self-worth, sort of negative evaluations of themselves. Okay, so, I mean, I'm not encouraging you to go out and splurge on a binge, an eating binge, think, okay, I could just eat as much as I want, I could get fat, don't have to take care of myself anymore, doesn't matter how I look, since it's all not mine. But it helps to break all of these negative emotions that center around the body. Okay, and now, in the next paragraph, Sariputta is going to approach the contemplation of the earth element in the body from a different angle. This is going to be from the angle of its impermanence, and then using the impermanence as a way to see into the selfless nature of the body. So he says, there comes a time when the water element is disturbed or agitated. This is supposed to be, I guess, the time in the future when the world is about to dissolve and disappear, and then the external earth element vanishes. Wow, this is actually getting close with the global, really seriously, with the global warming. You know, the sea level is going to be rising and rising and rising, swallowing up the earth.
Water, the ocean.
Yeah. Okay, so even this external earth element, great as it is seen to be impermanent, subject to destruction, disappearance, and change. So let alone the earth element being devoured or swallowed up by the waters, but we know that there'll probably come a time when, you know, as the universe expands, keeps on expanding and expanding. Actually, there'll come a time in the future when the sun explodes. It will collapse in upon itself and then explode. And then that heat of the sun will just completely burn up this earth, the whole planet Earth. You know, it might be millions of years in the future, but eventually it will happen. And so we know this definitely is a scientific fact. And so we consider how this earth element will eventually disappear, and all of human life and civilization on the earth will disappear. And so when that is the case, what of this body, which is clung to by craving and lasts but a little while? So this body, now, I'm 65 years old, I can recollect so clearly the time in 1982 when I went back to Sri Lanka after spending 3 years in the Sri Lankan Vihara in Washington, D.C. That is, from now, what is it, 28 years? Okay, so now 28 plus 65, 93, will I be here? And it just seems to me that that day when I went back to Sri Lanka, it seems almost like three days ago. I can remember it so clearly. And yet 28 years, and what you might notice as you get older, I guess you're all pretty much youngsters. No? So maybe you have this experience. Doesn't it seem that each year goes by more quickly?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody agrees.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Anybody has the opposite experience, that a year seems to go more slowly, to be more drawn out as you get older?
Yeah, it's the total opposite. It goes much more quickly.
Yeah.
Wait till you're 80.
Part of the reason for that is that each year is a smaller percentage.
Yeah, I know. So when you're 2 years old, and like 1 year is one half of your life. And so those 28 years which have gone by so quickly, and now I just think 28 years in the future, and I'm not going to be, probably not going to be here to look back upon that. Of course, I might be here. But if I do make it to 93, I don't think I will have much more time after that. But also, what's very remarkable is that, you know, when you get to be in your upper 90s, normally we don't even think, like, you know, I'm 92. How many people who get to be 92 make it to 93? How many people that get to be 93 make it to 94? You know, you speak to 90-year-old people and they're still planning what they're going to be doing 4 years, 5 years in the future. Not everyone. But there is quite a lot. Okay, so one reflects on this body, and then one sees how this body is just transient. And then when one sees how the body is so transient, then one can understand that there's no validity in considering this body to be I, or mine, or I am. Okay, so this is getting the sense of the body as being not I, not mine. So one is breaking the grip of, I use two words, little complicated English words, to represent this attitude towards the body. One is appropriation. That means taking the body as one's possession. The sense, the body is mine. Somehow we have a sense, I am something different from the body, but I own it. I possess it. So that's appropriation. The other word is identification. That is identifying with the body, taking the body to be I am. Okay, so now Sariputta is going to show, maybe at this point I'll ask whether there's any questions.
Yeah. I wonder if you could give one more example, like the food. Body. No,
with the earth element.
Yes. I wonder if you can give one more example, say using years. Or, in other words, that example is terrific.
Yeah. Food. Yeah.
So I just wonder if there's another way of considering it. That's sort of an easy one. what, you know, what are you taking in and moving out that's become? I'm sorry, I don't.
Yeah, my imagination. It's a little impoverished.
Maybe your hair.
You don't take the hair into the body. Unless you, it would be a strange person that would absorb the hair. What is
some? Food is the only thing you can take in.
Oxygen.
Well, let's say the oxygen would be come under the air element.
Fragrances.
That, I think, would come under the air element.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah.
But actually, with the fragrance, yeah. Because what is the fragrance? But it's actually a very small, but it's more liquid usually. But it's small little liquid particles. But of course, even in the liquid particle, there's some solidity, so there's some earth element there. So the fragrance would not become assimilated to the body. It will just pass through and then eventually get eliminated in some way.
Plastic surgery.
Plastic implant. But that is not something which is really assimilated to the body. It's something put into the body. That's not quite the earth element. Let's just leave it at food. Yeah.
I have a metal rod in my leg that's a pretty solid piece of earth. And they put it in my leg in order to have my leg work properly and give me the ability to stand.
Okay, so maybe that is, you could say that that is earth element.
Okay.
Okay, so let's go on. Now Sariputta is going to show how to use this as a basis for contemplation in order to develop equanimity in the face of abuse and mistreatment by others. And probably he's speaking from actual experience as Buddhist monks in India during the time of the Buddha, where it was quite different from the way Buddhist monks would be treated in a strictly Buddhist country, where they're always usually shown respect. You have to qualify that. I could think of so many examples of Sri Lanka of monasteries being robbed, sometimes monks being beaten. But in India during the Buddha's time, there were large Brahmin communities which were quite hostile to ascetics. And so Sariputta says, so then, if others abuse, refile, scold, and harass a bhikkhu, a monk, so he would have the experience, maybe if he arrives at a village of Brahmins, not knowing that it's a Brahmin village, then they will yell at him, "Baldy, why don't you let grow your hair? What are you going about in that tattered robe for?" And even Sariputta himself came from the Brahmin class. And when he would go for alms round, sometimes he would come to his own village and his mother would scold him. She would say, "Why did you become a monk? You could have been a good Jewish boy." I'm sorry. a good Brahmin boy. Why don't you get married? Why don't you grow your hair? Put on a pair of trousers and a shirt. Get a job. Okay, so then he understands in this way. This painful feeling born of air contact has arisen in me. That is dependent, not independent. Dependent on what? Dependent on contact. Okay, so normally what happens, somebody yells at at us, abuses us, insults us. So then what we do, sort of instinctively and naturally, we grasp upon the words, the meaning of the words, and then we build upon the meaning of the words. This is a process of papancha, conceptual elaboration or conceptual proliferation. Ah, he's insulting me. Is there something wrong with me? Let me look in the mirror. Or how could he speak about me like that way? And so, instead of thinking in that way, in letting the sound turn into meaningful words, then grasping upon the words and building up self-referential concepts on the basis of the words, one considers this from the standpoint of, we call this the process of dhammas, the process of phenomena, that there is a sound and the ear. The sound impinges on the ear, it draws the mind to the sound. So hearing consciousness arises. And the hearing of the sound and the understanding of the words all depends upon this contact, the contact of consciousness with the sound through the ear. So one sees how this whole event is just a sequence of dependently arisen processes. Okay, then one sees that the contact is impermanent. Even if somebody is continuing to yell at you, to insult you, to revile you, it's a succession of contacts is taking place. One word comes out from the mouth, the set turns into sound, the sound strikes the ear, and that is the contact. And so that contact is impermanent, vanishing. Then based upon that contact, the feeling arises. So that feeling, in this case, the feeling that arises from interpreting the sound as being directed against you, an insult or abuse, that feeling is impermanent. That perception is impermanent. These mental formations are impermanent. And that consciousness is impermanent. So here we actually have all of the five aggregates that are brought in here. The sound and the ear, these belong to the form aggregate. And then through the interplay or interaction of sound and ear, there is the contact. And from contact arises a feeling, perception, and then certain reactions. The reactions are the formations of volitional activities. So that is the three types of mental events, which are impermanent. And then there's the awareness of this, the knowing of this. That is the consciousness. That too is impermanent. Okay, so then it says, his mind, having made an element its objective support, or even having made the elements its objective support, enters into that and acquires confidence. This actually means a kind of steadiness or tranquility. Well, tranquility or calmness, steadiness and resolution or determination. So what one has done here is to take this event of being in this experience of being reviled or scolded or insulted, and one breaks it down into an experience of the five aggregates. And one knows that the five aggregates are not self, not I, not mine. And so when treats the experience in terms of these elements of experience. And in this way, the agitation that tends to arise calms down, settles down, the mind becomes tranquil, and then one becomes steady or concentrated, so one could build up even a samadhi in the course of this experience. And then one becomes resolute, focusing upon this experience in terms of the elements. Okay, now the text says, if others attack, now we're going to see even more extreme types of mistreatment. If others attack that bhikkhu in ways that are unwished for, undesired, disagreeable, that is, by contact with fists, they beat him with their fists, or with clods of earth, they throw soil at him, or hit him with sticks or with knives, then, you know, instead of getting angry and upset, one reflects, this body is of such a nature that contact with fists, clods, sticks, and knives assail it. One could do this kind of reflection or contemplation not only when attacked by other people, but also if illness assails the body. One gets very ill, troubled by really strong painful feelings, instead of falling into self-pity and then becoming dejected, depressed, one can reflect, this is the nature of the body, is to fall ill. As long as I have this body, I can't completely escape illness. Of course, it doesn't mean that you just lie in bed and don't contact a doctor or take medicine, but you use this contemplation as a way to dispel the feelings of misery that arise or self-pity that arise because of the illness. Okay, but now we're coming to this rather severe case where somebody could be like sometimes gangs of robbers. They think that hoodlums, they'll actually beat the monk. Actually, I remember in the U.S. in the early 1990s, there was a case of a Thai temple in Arizona that was attacked, and the monks were killed. I don't remember who was responsible for that. Members of the Thai community who disliked the monks? Or whether it was just outside gangsters who thought, I think it was actually outside hoodlums who thought that the temple had precious Buddha statues with jewels and gems inside. So I think they attacked the temple and killed the monks in order to steal the Buddha images. Okay, but now this monk recollects a saying of the Buddha. This is from a sutta that we studied earlier this year. It's the sutta on the simile of the saw, number 21 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Here the Buddha says, even if bandits were to sever you savagely, limb by limb with a two-handled saw, one who gives rise to hatred towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Okay, so in this way, when this monk reflects upon that statement of the Buddha while he's being beaten, then he continues and thinks, tireless energy should be aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness should be established. My mind will be tranquil and untroubled But my body will be tranquil and untroubled, and my mind will be concentrated and unified. And now let those fists, claws, sticks, and knives attack this body, for I'm now practicing the Buddha's teaching. So this is like the real test that separates, as they say, the men from the boys, or the real practitioners from the weekend meditators. So all of you line up and I'll get one of these Zen sticks. Okay, so one is getting beaten, then one sets up one's, instead of retaliating and hitting back, one sets up the energy, establishes one's mindfulness, and then one tries to make the mind concentrated. But it shouldn't just be passive. If somebody is actually attacking you, you're entitled to attack back in order to defend yourself. So if you know some kind of martial arts, you should defend yourself. You could think, this is just five aggregates that's attacking that guy. Just five aggregates, which is flipping him over to the ground. So you want to avoid inflicting any kind of lasting damage on the person, but you could threaten the person back. If you have like an umbrella, you could hold up the umbrella. If you have some stick, you could hold up the stick. If you know the martial arts, you could use martial arts on him. And you could try to defend yourself. But if, you know, you don't have that ability and you're being overwhelmed, then you use this reflection in order to keep the mind tranquil. Okay, so now it says, when that monk thus recollects the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. He's recollecting the Buddha because he thinks of that statement of the Buddha. He's recollecting the Dhamma because he's thinking of the actual advice or teaching that the Buddha gave. And he's recollecting the Sangha because this is the advice. Those are the ones who listen to and were to apply the advice that the Buddha gave. And so when he recollects the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha in this way, then this wholesome equanimity should become established in him. But if the equanimity doesn't become established in him, then he should arouse what is called the sense of urgency. He reflects, it is a loss for me, it is no gain for me, it is bad for me, not good, that when I thus recollect the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, equanimity does not become established in me. Just sound impinging on the ear. Contact has arisen. Feeling has arisen. Perception. Mental activities. Conscious. But somebody tell them to please stop. So he thinks in this way that it's unfortunate for me that I'm not able to establish this wholesome equanimity. Okay, then he refers, this would be, I think, a common situation in an Indian family, maybe not so much in an American family, when the daughter-in-law sees her father-in-law, she arouses some sense of urgency to please him. Because in the Indian family, when the girl marries the boy, she goes to live in the extended family of of her husband, and everybody is sort of looking at her. Is she going to measure up to our standards? You have experience of this yourself?
Mother will not come in tomorrow.
Yeah, so they're looking, you know, very critically, and I guess the tendency is always to find fault. I don't know, is this in the case in the Chinese family also? It is?
The mother-in-law
is more severe than the father-in-law.
Yeah. Father-in-law is usually a
problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes the daughter-in-law's tough.
Yeah, I think the mother-in-law is always looking at the daughter-in-law, because the daughter-in-law, she's married her son, so she's, is his wife going to take care of my son properly?
She might not like the mother-in-law. In the Korean tradition, the mother-in-law is not a very favorite person, so the daughter-in-law instinctively doesn't like the mother-in-law.
Yeah, but in the Indian family, the mother-in-law always sits in judgment on the daughter-in-law. How is she taking care of my son? Oh, she gives him the tea in the morning, but she only puts out one spoon, not two spoons the way I would do it. So he has one spoon to put in the sugar, another spoon to stir the tea. What kind of girl is that? What kind of upbringing does she have? Always finding fault. Okay, but in this case, it's the daughter-in-law with the father-in-law, so she's always anxious. She has to please him. Okay, and so when the bhikkhu recollects the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, then he stirs up this sense of urgency in order to establish this wholesome equanimity. Okay, but if when he recollects thus the Buddha Dhamma and Sangha, this wholesome equanimity is established in him, then he is satisfied with it. And then Sariputta sums up and says, at that point, much has been done by that bhikkhu. Okay, I think we'll have to take the break now and then come back. After the lunch, we could come back and have discussion about what we've covered. Okay, so we'll end the presentation by sharing the merits. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu sasana akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu desana akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu mangparam eta vatacha amhehi Sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabbe bhutanumodantu sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadhaya vichihetato etantare satakai upapanna rupiya rupicha asanya sanino Dukkha pamucchantu pusantu nibbutin. Okay, we do have a class next week and we'll continue with the sutta, hopefully finish it next week. Okay, so we end with the three bells.
Thank you.